Today, maybe we'll do things a little bit differently from what we usually do. Usually I give a talk, and then we have small group discussions, and then after that, we all come together and talk some more. But today I want to do it a little differently. I'll give a talk, and then after I give the talk, we'll all talk a bit, and then I think I'll go away. So I say bye and go a little early because I just found out my wife Kathy was running on the trail and she fell down, planted her face right in there. So she looks pretty bad. I actually ran home during the lunchtime to see her and she looks funny. Bled a lot of bleeding, and her nose is all swollen. So she just now told me that we do need to go to the emergency room. So I'm going to do all that, and then I'll leave a little early, and then after I'm gone, you can do kinhin and service. And so I'll leave a little bit early. Anyway, I did see her at lunchtime, so I feel reassured that she's not, you know, in some sort of dire situation. But she did call the doctor and does need to go to the emergency room. Well, what a great day at Green Gulch, right? Pretty beautiful. Too bad you all had to spend a day indoors. I wouldn't be surprised if there wasn't somebody who snuck away. I would. Go out for a walk somewhere. It's such a beautiful day, and I hope that after we're done here, it's early enough that maybe you'll have a chance to stroll a little bit down toward the garden and enjoy the day. On a day like today, you can easily forget that there's a lot of suffering all around you, all around us, and inside of us, everyone. Sometimes even the sitting causes you suffering because it's your knee hurts or something like that, or your mind is unruly. So if you had some suffering caused by the practice today, I hope it wasn't too bad. And I hope that you still feel as if it was worthwhile for you to have spent the day this way. Because this is the path to address suffering. And it is a good path. And sometimes it takes a little while, but I can tell you that it really does work. We, some of you, will know that every week, as part of our practice, is our weekly Dharma meeting, our weekly Dharma seminar. And we always take up the study of a text. And we spend a month or more than a month studying one text, and then we study something else. Usually the next thing we study says the opposite of what the last text said. And we've been studying the Dhammapada, classical text of Buddhism. Dhammapada roughly translates as the path of Dharma. And it's a very inspiring text made up of 423 aphoristic, short aphoristic verses organized into 26 chapters. Probably it is the most translated of all Buddhist texts. I think there are more than 50 English translations of the Dhammapada. It is also one of the, if not the first, Buddhist text to come to the West. Believe it or not, it was first translated into Latin in 1855, and soon thereafter translated into German in 1860. I'm not sure when it was translated into English, but it was in the 19th century. And Western, it was translated, of course, by scholars of religion, and they were really impressed to discover a very strange Asian religion that seemed, unlike other religions, to be very reasonable. You know, really reasonable and psychologically astute. And that was focused on self-transformation and self-transcendence rather than on the worship of a supreme being. And these Western scholars were also astonished to find that Buddhism didn't even seem to have the idea of a supreme creator being. And in Western religion, that's like point number one. God created the heavens and the earth. That's the first thing. But the Buddhists didn't seem to worry about that. So they were very, Western scholars were a very strange thing. How could that be? They didn't, is it a religion? They asked. I often say that when they had the first Parliament of World Religions in 1893, they had a debate whether to include the Buddhists or not. Because how could they be a religion if they didn't have a god? All religions were different gods and worshiping, but if no god, is it a religion? So they were impressed with this strange thing. And the Dhammapada was the first text that was a simple, straightforward exposition of the main values and practices of Buddhism. So we studied it in our seminar. Our seminar has been going on now for 25 years, so we study lots of things again. We studied the Dhammapada before, but we studied it again this time and just finished it last Wednesday. So that's why today I want to start again, over again at the beginning. Although next Wednesday we're going to go on to something else, but today I was inspired to start over again at the beginning with the first chapter of the Dhammapada, which is called Dichotomies, a set of contrasting or dichotomous verses. So you'll have a verse and another verse which says the opposite. So in one set of verses we are hearing about the life that you will live without spiritual practice. And according to the Dhammapada, a life without spiritual practice is going to be a difficult life full of frustration and suffering. And no matter how hard you try to avoid it, you will not be able to avoid fundamental pain. In the contrasting verses, we learn of the path of the Buddha, a path of wisdom and compassion and diligent spiritual effort that will lead to the end of suffering and to peace and happiness. Now you might think that this contrast is a little bit black and white, possibly exaggerated and unrealistic, and maybe it is, but is the Dhammapada wants to show us in as clear and unambiguous a way as possible the choice that any of us is faced with as a human being. Will we intentionally focus the strength of our lives and our energy on character and goodness? Or will we do what is the most usual thing that people do, engage in the pursuit of external satisfaction and inevitably be disappointed when the external world does not produce the circumstances that we need for happiness? So we have that choice. That's what it means to be human, is to always have that choice. So Dhammapada wants to make that choice as clear and sharp as possible. So I'm going to read you the first chapter and comment on it, and maybe into the second chapter. Dichotomies. All experience is preceded by mind, led by mind, made by mind. Speak or act with a confused mind, and suffering follows, as the wagon wheel follows the hoof of the ox. All experience is preceded by mind, led by mind, made by mind. Speak or act with a peaceful mind, and happiness follows like a never departing shadow. We never think of this, but of course it is self-evidently obvious that any moment of experience has two elements: the object that we are experiencing, and the mind that cognizes that object. Most of the energy of our lives is spent in pursuit of the external object. Right? We plan to do things and we do them. We plan to have things and we get them. We establish a way we like to live and we go about creating that way. We want a partner so we're not lonesome. We find a partner. All of these things are external things that it makes sense to us to spend our entire lives doing. Going shopping, you know, entertainment. Probably a lot of you are going to have some fun right after the sitting because you made a plan. And you have a car that got you here because you bought it. We need external focus, but not at the expense of totally ignoring the mind. Because, in fact, it is the mind that conditions the experience of our living. And mind doesn't just mean intellect here in this verse. It means consciousness, awareness. The spiritual path begins with the recognition of how important the mind is and the resolution that we are going to take care of and develop the mind, not just forget about it and get external objects that we need. And the metaphor in this verse of the ox cart is really apt. Think about it. Once the wheels of an ox cart cut ruts in the ground, in the dirt, the next ox cart that comes along is going to probably find it easiest to go in those same ruts. Keep that up for a while, and that's the only way to go. Those ruts get pretty deep. It'd be hard to go any other way in your ox cart. When we don't pay attention to our words, our deeds, our thoughts, we're cutting roots. Ruts, I should say, not roots, ruts. When we speak and act with care, we eventually get out of the rut that we're in. And happiness will follow us effortlessly, the verse says, like a shadow that goes wherever we go. They abused me, attacked me, defeated me, robbed me. For someone hostile like this, hatred doesn't end. They abused me, defeated me, robbed me. For someone not hostile like this, hatred ends. So in both cases, the person is robbed and abused. But in one case, the response is hatred. In the other case, the response is non-hatred. Hatred never ends through hatred, the next verse says. But not by non-hate alone does it end. And this is an ancient truth. Hatred, enmity, resentment, and other emotions like these are very painful to experience, even if we have good reasons to feel them. Our feeling them is painful. And aren't we seeing this now in the world we live in with all of its horrible wars and divisions? To be sure, sometimes people are pretty rotten and richly deserve our enmity. But the point that the Buddha is making here is that when our mind is full of enmity, even if it's warranted, we're the ones who suffer for this. Hatred doesn't cure hatred. Love cures hatred. War doesn't bring peace. Peace brings peace. Division doesn't cure division. Unity cures division. Maybe there are just wars and unjust wars. Maybe there are just causes and unjust causes. But from the Buddha's point of view, no war, no division, no hatred is ever a solution to evil. Many, next verse, verse 6, many do not realize that we here must die. For those who realize this, all quarrels end. We're all born, and that is why we all die. That is the cause of death, being born. All other causes are incidental. And since we're all like this, every one of us, we are actually quite closely related, and we are inherently sympathetic to one another. And we understand one another's hearts very well. When you look at your enemy, the person who has hurt you, you do not see another sorry human being who is soon going to die. You see a big, powerful foe who is trying to hurt you. But if you look deeply at that same powerful foe, you will see another poor human being, just like you, who is going to have to face death soon and lose everything they have. If we all realized and remembered this, one true fact about our lives, we would be a whole lot more forgiving of one another. The next verse is, whoever lives focused on the pleasant, senses unguarded, immoderate with food, lazy and sluggish, will be overpowered by Mara as a weak tree is bent in the wind. Whoever lives focused on the unpleasant, senses guarded, moderate with food, faithful and diligent, will not be overpowered by Mara as a stone mountain is unmoved by the wind. So in these two verses, we're beginning to get an idea of the method of the practice, how the practice works. So the usual, obvious way to go about our human lives is to go toward what's pleasant, right? What we like, what we want, and to avoid what we don't want. Who doesn't do this? I mean, this is the way, just obvious. Everybody does this. We don't even have to learn it. We just do this. Common sense. Everybody does it. But it's not a good idea. Because the inevitable result of that will be a strong habit of suffering. Because, in the end, you cannot ensure that you are going to get what you want and that life is going to be as you wish that it will be. And that you can successfully avoid the things you don't want. That is actually not possible. And if it looks like it's possible for a while, that's a big deception. That's why the Buddha's way is totally counterintuitive. Instead of trying to get what you want, be suspicious. And instead of running away from what you don't want, face it. Be with it. Don't be scared of it. And this is meant to be practiced on a very minute level. on a sensual and perceptual level, moment by moment. Because part of our perception and our just cognizing the world has to do with this very subtle grasping and avoiding. And this is where the meditation practice is very, very important. Because you are training your mind to be subtle enough to notice these things. You're training your mind to have the capacity to simply be present with experience, whether you like it or not. If this is what's happening, it is what's happening. What's happening doesn't care whether you like it or not. It's going to be whatever it is. And you are training your mind to be present with whatever is happening. You're training your mind to have the capacity to let things come and let them go without being entangled in them. Mara is the evil one, the tempter, who encourages our folly. And when we live under Mara's regime, we will be very wobbly. And we'll blow this way and that way, whichever way the wind blows, that's the way we're going to blow. Things go well, we'll be very happy. Things don't go well, we'll be very miserable. Blowing back and forth, totally at the mercy of conditions. But when we practice the Buddha way, we will have an unshakable integrity. Firm like a mountain, impervious to the wind. Feels the wind, but is not blown around by it. Next verses. Whoever is defiled and devoid of self-control and truth, yet wears the saffron robe, is unworthy of the saffron robe. Whoever has purged the defilements, is self-controlled, truthful, and well-established in virtue, is worthy of the saffron robe. The saffron robe is the robe traditionally worn by Buddhist monastics, who we hope, ideally, are committed to practicing very carefully and diligently the Buddha way. But it turns out that it's possible to be a monastic and not really develop the mind and heart to, you know, follow the rules and live the lifestyle, but not really do the inner work of practice. And throughout the Dhammapada, all through all the chapters, almost every chapter has a line, a verse like this, Buddha warning monastics. Don't think that just because you put on this robe, everything is fine. You have to do the work. You have to purify the heart. And you can do this whether you're a monastic or not. Those who consider the inessential to be essential and see the essential as inessential don't reach the essential, living in the field of wrong intention. Those who know the essential to be essential and the inessential as inessential reach the essential, living in the field of right intention. It's really easy to live a trivial life. Nothing could be easier. Especially now, there are so many kinds of entertainment readily available. So many kinds of sophisticated distraction, literally flooding our attention, screaming for our attention, that it would be the easiest thing in the world to live your entire life from beginning to end, awash in the trivial, the irrelevant, the inessential, and the external, without ever noticing what's really important about being human, the quality of your mind and heart. And once we see what is essential, we have to set our minds on it, develop the intention to live an essential life, and make every effort to carry out that intention. As many of us know, it takes support and help and all kinds of things, but we can find all that and carry out that intention. As rain penetrates an ill-thatched house, So lust penetrates an uncultivated mind. As rain does not penetrate a well-thatched house, a well-thatched house in contrast to an ill-thatched house, so lust does not penetrate a well-cultivated mind. And here it uses lust, the word lust, but it doesn't just mean lust. It means all kinds of powerful mental and emotional states that come over us and carry us away. When we're on the path of cultivation of our mind and heart, maybe we still have those states. They don't necessarily entirely disappear, but now we know how to live with them so that they don't captivate us, capture us. We learn from this verse a little bit of anthropology. We learn that in ancient India they thatched roofs, which they still do in a lot of parts of the world. Not only in Asia, but I've seen thatched roofs in Latin America. In Japan, they have thatched roofs. If you thatch your roof carelessly, it's going to leak like a sieve. If you do it very carefully and thoroughly, it won't leak. And you'll be dry and comfortable, even in the big monsoon rains. One who does evil grieves in this life, grieves in the next, grieves in both worlds. Seeing one's own defiled acts brings grief and affliction. One who makes merit rejoices in this life, rejoices in the next, rejoices in both worlds. Seeing one's own pure acts brings joy and delight. And again, here, it uses strong language, but evil doesn't mean just, you know, what we would call evil, heinous acts. It also means just careless, everyday stuff that we all do. You know, we don't always speak and act and think with our best mind. And the Buddhist path involves living carefully and with integrity and kindness towards self and others all the time. Certainly in large matters, but even in very small everyday matters. And when you take care of your life like this, you'll be happy. Not only today, but tomorrow, and in worlds and lifetimes to come. If not, there will be regret. And regret is sad. There's something kind of horrible about regret. I should have done better, but I didn't, and now I can't undo or do what I failed to do. It's too late. But a lot of times it's not too late. And you can use your regret to do better next time. The regret can be, the pain of regret can be a motivator. But in this verse, I think the understanding is it really is too late for this person. They're really grieving over a totally misspent life, and it really is too late. You can imagine how horrible that must feeling would be at the very end. Oh no! Oh no. One who does evil is tormented in this life, tormented in the next, is tormented in both worlds. Here one is tormented knowing, I have done evil. Reborn in realms of woe, one is tormented all the more. One who makes merit is delighted in this life, delighted in the next, delighted in both worlds. Here one is delighted knowing, I have made merit. Reborn in realms of bliss, one delights all the more. So these verses continue the thought of the previous verses. And notice that the assumption here, and this is the assumption that the Buddha makes in his teaching, that all of us are basically decent and want to do the right thing. There are some people who are so twisted up by what has happened to them that they are completely alienated from their best intentions, can't find them, but they're there. Actually, the early Buddhists had big debates on whether or not there ever could be such a thing as a person who is through and through just evil. They debated this. But I think mostly the answer was no, there cannot be such a person through and through unalloyed evil. So we're all basically decent, and therefore I think when we do bad stuff, we are tormented by it. Even someone whose torment is buried so deep that they have no idea of it consciously, the torment is there. Cruelty, violence, selfishness, greed, hatred, domination. This is not a happy path for anybody, even the people who manage it successfully, apparently. To be and do good is a happy and a peaceful path, not only for this life, but for lives and worlds to come. And just to say, without going into it much, in Buddhism, it is just taken for granted that there is more to life than we can see and know. It's taken for granted that there are many worlds and many lifetimes. And the point of that is to know that what we do in this life matters more than just for this life. That's the point of that view. And I think it's true. We are powerful. What we do really matters. One who recites many teachings but being negligent doesn't act accordingly like a cowherd counting others' cows doesn't attain the benefits of the life of practice. But one who receives even a few teachings and yet lives according to the Dharma, letting go of passion, ill will, and delusion, aware with a mind well freed, not clinging in this life or the next, attains the benefits of the contemplative life or the spiritual life. So, you've heard this before, and it's very obvious that knowing a lot of teachings and memorizing them and being an expert on the scriptures is not the point. The point is to live the teachings. One teaching is enough. One line is enough. And not only to live them, but to make them your own. To shape your life and character around them. And the only way you do that is to recognize that they have been there in you from the beginning. They're not something that came from outside. You realize, oh, I've always felt this way. Passion, ill will, and delusion are usually translated greed, hate, and delusion. And they're the so-called three poisons that are the source of all afflicted states of mind and conduct, and they are the ultimate cause of all of our human suffering. To want and to crave, to reject, condemn, and push away, and not to really know who you are and what you are, that's the way we suffer. And to abandon these is to automatically give rise to their opposites, love, patience, and forgiveness with what is. And then we understand. And that's freedom. When there's no fearful clinging to anything, even life. Just a confident contentment in every moment of living as it really is. Those are the last verses of the first chapter. I'll just read a couple of verses from the next chapter and then I'll stop. Next chapter is called Vigilance, or we could say paying attention. Always paying attention. Vigilance is the path to the deathless, negligence the path to death. The vigilant don't die. The negligent are as if already dead. Knowing this distinction, vigilant sages rejoice in vigilance, delighting in the field of the noble ones. Absorbed in meditation, persevering, always steadfast, the wise touch nirvana, the ultimate rest from toil. So this is a little, you have to appreciate, you know, the special use of these words in Buddhism. In Buddhism, the deathless is another name for nirvana. It's a synonym for nirvana, with a capital D, the deathless. Because in the context of the Dhammapada and of Buddhism in general, this is very weird for us. In Western thought, it doesn't have this way of looking at it, but it seems so obvious to us, right? Death is the opposite of life, right? But no, in Buddhism, death is not the opposite of life. Life and death is a hyphenated word. It's one thing. And the opposite of that hyphenated pair is nirvana, the deathless. In other words, death, what we call death, doesn't mean death in Buddhism. In Buddhism, because we think of death as a final end, but Buddhism doesn't think of death as a final end. Death in Buddhism really means the restless craving and obsession that goes on and on and on, causing us grief and propelling us from one catastrophe to the next. Now, we don't need to be reborn into another life to know what that feels like, right? But in Buddhist, the idea is that this goes on and on and on. You die and it goes on and even after that. To enter nirvana is to enter the deathless. The end to that restlessness and a profound contentment, happiness, and peace. To ignore the path is to constantly feel, sometimes powerfully and sometimes very subtly, dis-ease. Whereas to follow the path is to find complete and lasting peace regardless of outward circumstances. It goes without saying that any time we can improve outward circumstances, we should do that the best we can. But we understand that it is impossible to create always circumstances that we want for ourselves or the world. We might not be able to do that, but we do have the power, each one of us, to perfect our hearts. And in this way, to know peace. And in these verses, you hear the mention of the word meditation. And again, meditation is the way that we increase our ability to pay attention, increase our ability to notice, and here, in this context, it increases our stability, stabilizes the mind for the path, because it's very easy to be knocked off track. So when we sit, it brings us back. Well, I'm going to stop there and now open for comments and questions, anybody who has something to say. We have the mic somewhere we can pass around, and we can talk for about 20 minutes, and then we'll chant and bow and say goodbye. So anybody have anything they want to bring up? And also, maybe some people online have things to say. You can just raise your hand and get the mic. There's someone over that way. And someone over. Well, but the people online won't hear you without the mic.
Online need to hear you. I'm actually just curious, who is your favored translator, since there are so many translations, or who do you look to?
Mm-hmm. Well, in our seminar, we've been using the translation by our friend and colleague, Gil Fronsdahl, F-R-O-N-S-D-A-L. And it's a wonderful translation with lots, with footnotes and explanations. Yeah,
Thank you.
My favorite, yeah. My second favorite is Tanisaro Bhikkhu, which has the advantage of being free and available online. Tanisaro, T-H-A-N-I-S-S-A-R-O, who is a Western person, but a fully ordained bhikkhu in the Theravada tradition. Yeah, and there was somebody over here. Yeah, back here. Yeah.
My question is around finding a state of internal peace and forgiveness in the context of complicated relationships where there isn't an apology. Mm-hmm. Like, how can I find that place of acceptance for somebody who has harmed me but does not want to apologize or reconcile in that way, but I don't want to hold this feeling of like, it's kind of going to what you were talking about in the first chapter of like, if you want peace, you can't be in this framework of not peace or holding resentment or anger.
I'm really glad you brought that up. It's a really important point. I think a rule of thumb is the place where we practice is where we are. That's the only place you can practice. People think, I'm going to practice from where I should be. You can't practice where you should be because there is nobody there, right? The only place you can practice is where you actually are. That's really important. So, in this case, this happens a lot, right? It happens a lot. You're not alone in this. This is not saying, if you were really a good person, you would rush up to that nasty guy who hurt you, throw your arms around him and say, all is forgiven. No, that's not what this is saying. Start from where you are. And if you feel fear, resentment, or whatever you feel, that's what you feel. And you breathe with that feeling and try to understand it in yourself. It is important to realize this teaching. In other words, when I feel this, I do feel it. And when I feel it, it's very hard for me. That person who has hurt me in the past is still hurting me as long as I have this feeling. And that what I need to do is eventually overcome this feeling. And that's the important thing for you. Not to forgive the other person. Maybe that person is not worthy of your forgiveness. Especially if they go on doing the stuff that they're doing. They're not worthy of your forgiveness. So that's not a matter. Forget about them. It's about your feeling. And then through the course of your ongoing practice, you come to the place where you can release yourself from that feeling, so that even though you don't forgive the person, you don't like that person, you're not going to be around that person anymore, you yourself are relieved in your own heart from the pain. It's over for you. And so that might take a while. And until you're there, you don't try to say, why am I not there? What's wrong with me? I did it wrong. No, if you've been hurt, the most natural thing in the world, just like if, you know, like my wife fell down, right? She's got cuts all over her face. And she's supposed to say, what's wrong with me? If I were really a Buddhist, I wouldn't have any cuts on my face. No. You fall down, you get cuts on your face. Somebody hurts you, you feel hurt. It takes time. She's not going to have cuts on her face long because she can heal. So can you. But in the meantime, you put something on the cut, right? You go to the emergency room like we're going to do in a minute. You get treatment. So that's what you should do. Seek treatment and take care of your wounds. And now, I hope, hopefully, when you have released your heart, and let's hope that this other person, whoever hurt you, does the same thing and comes to you and says, I feel so awful. I didn't realize what I did. Will you forgive me? Maybe then you're ready to forgive them when they do that. But if they never do that and they go around hurting other people, they don't even care whether you forgive them. And it's not good for you to think that you're supposed to forgive them. No, just release your own feeling. Don't remain a victim forever and ever.